What's up, everyone? Welcome back to Dropping Dimes. This is the Weekly Dime, the show where we round up the most recent happenings in the world of quarantine basketball, I guess. I'm your host, Rodrigo, but you can call me Rod. And I'm joined by the guy who was Uber Eats' number one customer even before social distancing, Rafael. How are you doing, man?
I'm great. How about you? It's great to be back. It's been a while since last time we recorded together. It's great to be back, and there's a lot to talk about today, so it should be an exciting episode.
It is crazy that we live so close to each other and we cannot see each other, but so be it. Health is more important, and we hope that everyone out there is staying healthy and safe. But yeah, you said it right, Raf. We have a lot to talk about because, yeah, there's no NBA, but God bless ESPN. And I don't know if it's Michael Jordan's jealousy or what bit him, but we haven't talked about The Last Dance, and we're here to catch you up on the latest and greatest about The Last Dance, the docuseries about the 90s Bulls, and mostly Michael Jordan. Raf, are you up to date on The Last Dance?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like we have a lot of things to do out of the house, so we have a lot of free time to make sure that we are ready for the episode, to record the episode.
So what are some of your first impressions? Have you liked it? Do you think, is it fulfilling? Is it filling that basketball void in your life?
Of course. I mean, it's very entertaining. And for sure, it's a way of, you know, keeping ourselves connected to basketball, even during the quarantine. Now, we're going to talk about this, but as it happens with every sports documentary or sports TV show on Netflix or on ESPN, there's a lot of talk, a lot of controversy that comes from the episodes. And I think that's something that it's one of the topics to be covered today. I mean, all of the former NBA players talking about the episodes and how MJ talked about them and how were they mentioned and so on. I think that's something very interesting.
So let's try to go into the episodes because they come in twos. So we're trying to condense as much as possible the episodes. So don't get mad at us if we don't cover, you know, some of the nitty gritty details, but you know, we're open to hear you out. So let us know what you think once you check out the podcast, but let's dive right into episodes one and two, which is, I call it the origin story of the Bulls and Michael Jordan, right? One of the first things that I want to discuss is the Bulls, the origin of this 90s Bulls, because they were, Michael Jordan was drafted third in his class. Number one pick went to Hakeem Olajuwon. Number two, your Blazers chose Sam Bowie, which at the time, you know, as much as I like to make fun of your team, it wasn't a horrible decision. It made sense for the Blazers in retrospect. And some revisionist history, obviously they passed on the best player ever, arguably.
And we also passed on Kevin Durant.
And also passed on Kevin Durant later on, yeah. So 0-2 there. But you got Damian Lillard, I'll give you that. But yeah, it's crazy to think that, you know, Jordan was a highly coveted athlete out of college, right? Everyone knew Mike Jordan and Michael Jordan out of North Carolina, and he had some epic battles with Patrick Ewing in Georgetown. But the person that I didn't know came from a very small school is Pippen. He came from, I can't remember the name of the university, like Northern Arizona or something like that. And he was drafted so low. Like, I mean, they didn't get lucky because obviously this was all planned, but it's crazy to think that it is not easy to put together a team that has such a legacy. That's my point.
Yeah, and to be honest, I mean, he was not, even when he joined university, Pippen, he was not considered a very hot prospect for the NBA. And it's very interesting to see during the episodes how he talks about his development and how he became a better player and how much he grew from high school to his first year at university, how he kept his point guard skills, even though he was no longer a point guard. He was arguably the first player to have that set of skills, right? A player that could play, he could play the two or the three, and still he would handle the ball as a point guard. So it was definitely a time where basketball was changed forever when he was drafted.
And just a quick side note, I found Scottie Pippen's college. He went to Central Arkansas, which I'm going to go ahead. I haven't done my research, but I'm going to go ahead and say that I'm sure Scottie Pippen is the only person drafted out of Central Arkansas. I might be wrong, so feel free to let me know.
But, and maybe Dennis Rodman also might be the only one drafted from whatever university, college he attended, right? Because I can't
also
remember.
Also, we'll get into Dennis Rodman a little bit. But, yeah, also I'm going to go ahead and say that he was probably the only player drafted out of Cook County and Southeastern Oklahoma State.
Yes.
But, okay, so we have the Bulls, you know, they're together. They got Michael Jordan, and then they traded Charles Oakley. They got Ron Harper and Horace Grant, and that first three-peat team. And then the later three-peat team with Rodman, with Kerr, with Kukoc. But the man behind all of these moves is the now controversial, highly controversial, Jerry Krause. Now, I have a lot. I think I haven't fully digested how I feel about Jerry Krause, but what is your take? Do you think he really was the villain that he sort of is in the documentary?
To be honest, I don't know if I feel like the series or the TV show tries to give us this idea that he's the villain. Of course, the players didn't like him. And eventually he got, caught up with that idea of proving that the organization was more important than the players. But I think there's no way to argue against the fact that he did a pretty good job. I mean, he put together a great team. If you compare to what the team was before Mike was drafted, before MJ was drafted, and the trades that he worked out to put together a contender. I mean, there's no way around the fact that he was the architect behind that team. I don't think MJ would be able to get any rings with the original Bulls that he was drafted to. So Jerry Krause is a very important part. He's a very important part of that of those achievements, you know.
Yeah, I find it very hard to, I obviously he's not, things are not black and white with him, right? He's a complicated person in the sense that, at least to me, you know, we have this general manager who put together two of the best teams ever, arguably, you know, the 72 and 10 Bulls, 72 and 9 Bulls, is arguably the best team ever still, not on record because the Warriors later broke that record, but they did win the championship, the Bulls. And that's not easy. You have to do your homework quite a lot. And you could see him, you know, when part of his, how I think he was very hardworking because when he was following Tony Kukoc, in the documentary, it says that it is said that he even traveled to see Kukoc a few times. And you're not going to just do that without doing your homework and, you know, spending time watching the players. But then every time either Pippen or Jordan get asked or talk about Krause, and even in the footage from the 90s, you know, the way they treat Krause, it's on one hand, I understand it because there's this guy that broke the team in the end. But at the same time, it's like, oh, that's straight up bullying. And I guess it sort of goes with the culture of the time and you're with professional athletes and you sort of have to accept it. But, you know, there's that one point where I seen when Michael Jordan asks Jerry Krause, like, hey, do you want to shoot some layups with us? And then Jerry Krause is like, yeah, sure. And then Joe's like, yeah, we're going to have to lower the rim for you.
Yeah. I mean, even though the things that the players will say about him are not necessarily the best compliments, I think there's no way around the fact that all of them recognized his importance. Maybe they didn't get along on a personal level, but they recognized that he was an important piece of what they accomplished. And I think that probably his biggest mistakes were related to the way he addressed the media, because some of the things that he said to the media are things that should have been discussed behind closed doors. And yeah, you can try to, you know, send the same message across to the media without using the words that he used and without sounding as offensive to the current players. And just to use as an example, Toni Kukoc, again, Pippen felt that he was not appreciated, or he was underappreciated, because of the way that Jerry Krause was talking about Toni Kukoc, or even the way that he spoke about the fact that next year Phil Jackson would no longer be coaching the Bulls, and that's for the 97-98 season, if I'm not mistaken.
After that, so 98-99.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can take care of business. You can make sure that you start a rebuild, but you don't need to bring that to the media and create unnecessary drama. But having said that, we saw that the Warriors went through the same kind of process, and you could say that they should have learned from what happened with other teams in the past that had to go through a rebuild period after getting to the finals consecutive years and becoming champions and so on. And you see this, the same story kind of repeat itself, even though we already had other examples of how to handle these situations, right?
But yeah, I mean, that what makes it different is what with the Warriors, it was the players, right? They were causing the drama, and management was fairly quiet. With Krause, he started the drama almost. You know, he said next season will be Phil Jackson's last season, period. And that's when Jordan said, well, if Phil's not coming back, I'm not coming back. And then, yeah, I mean, he, like you said, I for the first time in the history of Dropping Dimes, I fully agree with what you said.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah, that's a first. That's an exclusive on Dropping Dimes. But I think, you know, Jerry Krause could have done a better job at handling his comments. He can still say that behind closed doors. And especially in the 90s, at that point, you could control the media a little bit more. It's not like today where people have Twitter and they can voice out their thoughts or any kind of social media, and that gets leaked immediately. Back then, yeah, there were cell phones and regular phones, but you could still control the message that came out of your mouth. And Jerry Krause didn't realize that.
And just to add to your point about Toni Kukoc and the fact that Jerry Krause went and scouted him and went overseas to watch him play and so on. Yeah. He was also the one that saw the potential, Phil Jackson's potential, right?
Yeah.
He gave him an opportunity to join the team. He saw his potential. And to a certain extent, he even helped him, you know, become a little bit more friendly when it comes to the corporate side of the business, dress better, handle interviews better, so that he would get that job. And once he was with the Bulls, Jerry Krause was always making sure that he was in a position where he could learn from the best. So he was under, I forgot his name, the coach
Tex
that
was... Huh? Tex Winter?
Yes. So he was under Tex Winter's wing at a time where Doug Collins didn't want to implement the triangle system. Yeah. But still, Jerry Krause saw the potential and wanted Phil Jackson to learn everything from Tex
Winter,
so that he could then be ready to take over, right, and implement those ideas. So, I mean, he influenced the organization in many, many positive ways. And then you can say that he also influenced the organization and the players in a negative way as well. But I mean, I think it would be the same with any GM that you put in that position. I mean, there's no perfect GM.
I think it is safe to say that, you know, you bring up the topic of the 90s Bulls, yeah, you're going to talk about Michael Jordan, not Jackson. Pippen, Rodman, Kukoc, you know, all the players, Phil Jackson, Tex Winter, and Jerry Krause. You will always be part of the conversation. and not Michael Jackson. Although Michael Jordan and Michael Jackson did a music video together.
Do you think Michael Jackson could ball?
No, even have you ever watched that video? Like parentheses, do you ever watch that video of Michael Jordan and Michael Jackson?
No.
I can't remember what's the name of the song, but there's footage of MJ and Michael Jordan, you know, dribbling, dunking, and then there's a few cuts where Jordan, quote unquote, guards and Michael Jackson, and he's trying to dribble, and it's super awkward.
Is it a music video?
I can't remember if it's a music video
or I mean, a commercial. If it's a music video, I can only remember another video where MJ it's basically acting with a artist, a music artist, and that's for Space Jam with R. Kelly. If that's the case, then MJ needs to do a better job selecting which music artist he wants to interact with, because he's 0-for-2 right there.
I don't think he interacted with R. Kelly. More like they used that footage of MJ. But this one, I found it. It's for the song Jam. How appropriate. And yeah, I'll send it to you. And people listening, check it out, because it's, you know, the whole thing was MJ versus MJ, the king of pop at the time versus the best of the best. Yeah. And trivia, I'm not a Michael Jackson fan, but I know my NBA trivia. There is another video with an NBA superstar with Michael Jackson. And that's Remember the Time. And Magic Johnson is there as a pharaoh.
Yeah, with Eddie Murphy, right?
With Eddie Murphy, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it would be interesting to see if they bring R. Kelly back for the new Space Jam for the soundtrack.
Trust me, they won't. They won't. But yeah, come for the Last Dance discussion. Stay for the Michael Jackson trivia. All right, let's quickly go over to wrap up episodes 1 and 2 about Scottie Pippen's contract, which was at the time criminally, underrated, and then MJ as the ultimate competitor. So Scottie Pippen's contract, he signed a long-term deal at the time it was a lot of money, but over the span of time then, over those 7 years, I think, or whatever it was, contracts just exploded, the salary cap exploded, so fast forward a couple of years, and Scottie Pippen is the 122nd something highest paid player in the NBA. Mm-hmm.
I mentioned the Warriors, and with this topic again, we can mention the Warriors, because to a certain extent there was always discussion with the Warriors as well, with Stephen Curry's contract and also with Draymond Green, and what would happen when the time comes to, you know, sign extensions with all of these players. So I think it's not necessarily something uncommon when you're talking about great teams that were assembled through draft or trades and not necessarily by free agency, right?
And I mean, eventually, that's a good comparison with Steph Curry. I mean, Steph got paid. He got his paycheck now when he most recently renewed his contract. And Pippen got his payday with the Blazers, right? After him, or was it Houston? I can't remember now. After he moved on from the Bulls.
First with Houston, with the Rockets. And then from the Rockets, he went to the Trail Blazers.
So both teams offered him hefty contracts to the point where career earnings-wise, and obviously Scottie Pippen had a longer career than Michael Jordan, had earned more money from playing Scottie Pippen than Michael Jordan. Now, obviously, these guys got shoe endorsements along the way and made a lot more money. But the one thing that I'm going to say is that scene where Jerry Reisenhorst, I think, the owner of the Bulls, says that, oh, I almost wanted to tell Scottie, like, hey, this is a bad contract. I was like, no, you didn't. Because, I mean, let's face it, it's a business, right? And at that point, it's not that you have a rival in front of you in the table, but you're the business owner. And if your employer says, your employee says, you know, I'm happy with this, I mean, unless you are an owner that really wants to look after your player, but given the nature of the NBA, you don't know if this guy is, you know, they can get injured tomorrow and then you have a contract to deal with. I just didn't believe when he said, like, oh, I wanted to almost warned him. It's like, no, Scottie said that and you probably were pretty happy about it.
But I think there was another scene. I think was maybe Scottie Pippen or maybe the owner as well, Jerry
Reisenhorf.
Yes, but I'm not sure who was talking, but they said basically that once they signed the agreement, that once they signed the contract back then, the owner would tell them, you know what, don't come knocking on my door if you want to talk about your contract, if you want to discuss an extension or if you want to change the terms on your contract. It's signed and that's what you signed, and back when you signed it, you agreed to the terms, so that's it. And I think it's a good scene as well to try to compare to the old NBA to the new NBA and how much power the owners had back then and how much power the players have now. Because I cannot imagine an owner being so close-minded and so strict nowadays, to the point of saying, you know what, don't come knocking on my door to discuss your contract, because nowadays they cannot afford to say something like that to their star or one of their co-stars.
And contracts have also evolved in a way that, you know, they are shorter to give players that option of, you know, I'm okay with one more year as we are, maybe to just secure that money, or, you know, this will be my last season. I'm going to try things out. So definitely a lot has changed. I mean, I don't necessarily feel bad for Scottie Pippen because he ended up making a lot of money. So,
and also, I mean, it would be interesting to ask Scottie, would you trade your rings for a better contract? Because if that's the case, like, then we will know that he's not satisfied with what he accomplished with the Bulls because he left money on the table. He could be getting a better deal somewhere else.
Yeah.
But maybe he would be with a franchise that wouldn't allow him to go to the finals every year, you know?
Also
and,
true.
And get a ring.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to speak on behalf of Scottie Pippen, but I think he had a good run. And yeah. I think he would have traded that. All right, let's talk about... go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, maybe without all of the rings that he got with the Bulls, he wouldn't still be as relevant as he is. He wouldn't have a job at one of the TV channels, like he's working for ESPN, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah,
for so, Jump, I mean, and other... The reason why he's still relevant to the point of getting a job with ESPN is also because of what he did when he was part of the league. We have some examples of players that were not champions and they're working for ESPN or for Turner. But these are guys that have a personality that it's to a certain extent more entertaining. Pippen is not as entertaining as Charles Barkley.
God, no. Yeah.
Or Jalen Rose or even, what's his name?
Kendrick Perkins.
Stephen Jackson. The one that, not Jackson, the one that played with the Warriors.
Yeah, Stephen Jackson.
Yeah, that's very controversial as well, right?
Yeah, no, Pippen is fairly dull when he speaks. Yeah. But
even Big Baby is working for a TV channel, right?
But Pierce is worse. Pierce is worse on TV than Pippen, 100%.
Yes. Yeah.
All right, let's move on to episodes 3 and 4 of the docuseries, which to a large extent focus on Dennis Rodman and the rivalry between the Pistons and the Bulls. And they actually do a very good job at intertwining those stories because Rodman was part of the Bad Boys Pistons. But let's start off with the Worm himself. I personally learned a lot about Dennis Rodman because I only knew the outrageous Rodman from the Bulls, right? Like the crazy hair and the outfits, and he later on, you know, choosing number 69 and David Stern saying, no, you're going to wear 70 because that's not okay. So I only knew that side of Rodman, and I knew that he was part of the Bad Boys Pistons, but I didn't know that he was homeless when he grew up, and, you know, he had mental health issues, and, you know, maybe how he was so much questioned about his sexuality, whereas nowadays, maybe that those questions wouldn't be as pressing. So my question to you, Raf, do you think that Dennis Rodman, you know, the Bulls Dennis Rodman, that three-peat Dennis Rodman, would have a place in today's NBA? You know, a player that halfway through the season tells you, I need a break and I need 48 hours in Vegas. Can I please get it?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that part when it comes to that break in Las Vegas. I think that also depends on what coach he's playing for. Some coaches would allow that.
Yeah.
Other coaches would definitely not allow that. And that's the same back then as it is now. I mean, I don't imagine, for example, Tom Thibodeau allowing him to go to Las Vegas for 48 hours, right? But if it's Steve Kerr, maybe yes. So it depends what coach you're playing for. But other than that, other than the break and going to Las Vegas and so on, I think that he would definitely have a place in the NBA today. And he's part of the reason why players like him have a place in the NBA today. He was the one that made sure to, you know, bend the rules a little bit and allow guys with a different personality to have a place in the NBA. And you could also mention Allen Iverson as another one that that really changed the way the NBA looked at their superstars' personality and how they behaved off court and how they dress and so on. But I think the NBA now definitely understands that having those superstars, it's more important than how they dress and what they're doing off court. But of course, there are some things that as an NBA superstar, you need to try to avoid. You don't wanna be, you know, constantly connected to scandals off court.
Right.
When it comes to drug-related issues or whatever, like domestic violence and stuff like that, that's never going to be okay. But I think that there's definitely more flexibility in today's NBA, and Dennis Rodman is part of the reason why there's more flexibility. I don't know if you have watched a movie about Dennis Rodman from the early 2000s, I think, late 90s. It's an HBO movie. It's a movie about his life, and they talk about his childhood and how he got to university. So I knew a lot of the things that they mentioned on The Last Dance because of that movie. It's very interesting. If you haven't watched it yet, you should definitely look for it. I don't remember the name, but we can definitely research and find out the name of the...
Also a 30 for 30, right, for of Dennis Rodman, if I'm not mistaken. I haven't watched any of those, but I'm now a lot more curious because, you know, to see his jump from the Bad Boys and how he looked, how he behaved to later on. I mean, you can see how he nowadays, he says that he was being himself, like he was truly being himself, right? Later on with the Bulls. And with the Pistons, it just maybe didn't work out for him. But let's talk about the Pistons. We're talking about them. The Bad Boys. I'm going to try to skip a few parts to go to one of the climatic parts of the docuseries, which is when the Bulls finally beat the Pistons after getting knocked out of the playoffs for 2 years straight by the Pistons, you know, in what I can only relate to as a wrestling match almost in an NBA court. And then the Pistons not shaking the Bulls' hands. What do you think about that?
I can relate to that as a fan and as someone that it's not a professional athlete. I can tell you that when I'm playing a soccer game, competitive soccer game, or playing a competitive basketball game, there were times where we lost and it was hard for me to cope with the idea of going to our opponents and shaking their hands. And I'm pretty sure that you've been through that as well. But we are not professional athletes, right? That's the main difference. It's not our job. And we are not used to dealing with these emotions as much as these guys should be, because they've been doing that their whole life. And at the end of the day, it's their job as well. So they should be able to handle this in a more professional way, with more sportsmanship. So I think there's no excuse. I think it was wrong. It's another thing to maybe relate their reaction to a game where they felt like the referees did them wrong and they were robbed and they were disappointed because of that. But I don't think that's the case. I mean, I haven't watched the game, the full games, right? But I never heard anything about the refs influencing the final result of that series. So I don't really see a reason for not shaking their hands, to be honest.
See, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of the referees, but you know, are there bad calls? Absolutely. Can a set of refs influence a whole series? I don't think so. But yeah, I mean, I haven't watched the entire series. My point, watching them doing that is that, and yes, sorry, let me go back. Yes, I've lost pickup games and, you know, competitive 5-on-5 games in basketball and in soccer when we used to play. And yeah, there are losses that I haven't taken so well, but nevertheless, I think, you know, you shake your opponent's hand, not for the respect that you might have for the opponent, but for this respect to the game itself. And it sounds very cheesy, but I do think, you know, you have to respect the game in the sense that, okay, this battle is over. Let's shake hands with the opponent, because that's the right thing to do. Whether I agree to it or not, that's another thing. So I thought it was very coward of the Pistons to do that, because, you know, to all great teams, and the Bad Boy Pistons are, I consider them more of a folklore team because of how they played and the style they played, rather than a tremendous powerhouse of basketball. You know, like, tremendous powerhouse of basketball is the Bulls, the Lakers, the Celtics, you know, teams that have won multiple times with great basketball. The Warriors nowadays, more of the Miami Heat, arguably. But the Pistons won because they beat the living crap out of everyone. And for them to walk away after being beaten legitimately, I thought that was coward. I actually got a little bit upset when, I don't know if you remember this, but when they are walking out of the arena and they pass through the Bulls bench, Isaiah Thomas kind of cowers a little bit. He kind of hides his head. I'm like, no, you better own that. If you're going to do it, own it. Don't hide. Don't hide amongst the centers in the team. If you're going to do it, own it.
So did you mention anything about how you feel about this when you met Isaiah Thomas?
No. And actually, I don't think I would like to meet Isaiah Thomas.
So isn't that coward of you as well? Not mention how you felt about him when you met him face to face?
I've never met him face to face, first of all. What? But when have I met him?
I thought you met him at a Foot Locker or maybe at SFU once. Wasn't he like, he was one of the NBA stars that went to SFU once or Foot Locker here in Vancouver?
No, so Isaiah Thomas was here at at an event actually with our partners, Vancouver Basketball and Victory. Big shout out to them. But that was a VIP event, and we were not part. This is a couple of years ago, even before we had Dropping Dimes, I think.
Okay.
And I didn't get a chance to meet him.
Okay.
If you know Bill Simmons, right?
Yeah.
So in his Book of Basketball, which is a fantastic book, by the way, I highly recommend it. He talks about the disease of winning and the secret and how, you know, he had a full-on discussion with Isaiah Thomas about this, but this comes after a huge beef with Isaiah Thomas for saying that he was a horrible GM, which he was. So I think I can see myself having a similar journey as Bill Simmons, you know, telling Isaiah Thomas, like, look, I think that was coward. That's my opinion.
Wasn't Isaiah Thomas the GM of the Pacers when they got to the finals? Or he was the GM of the Pacers, right?
Yeah, but he was also the GM for the Raptors, for the Knicks. Who else? I can't remember right now. And all those stories ended up tragically, honest. He was even accused of assaulting a few members of the organization. So... Mm-hmm. Do I respect him as a basketball player? Yes. I don't think he's behind Magic Johnson in my list of point guards. No. Is he great? He's one of the greatest of all times. Yeah. With top 100? Absolutely. Was he a coward for doing that particular action? Absolutely as well.
Yeah. I'm not sure where I would place him as far as like best point guards ever, but he's part of the list of top 50,
top 50
players of all time, right? He's part of the list. Yeah,
he made it. And I agree. I mean, the guy won an entire series with basically a broken ankle. And he's got heart. He's got determination. Listen, I'm not going to question his basketball resume. I will question his actions as a bad boy Piston because, you know, I don't think it was nice to win championships by cold sliding people and punching them to the ground.
Yeah.
But
I think that the problem that most people have with him, and I think I have this problem as well with Isaiah Thomas, is the fact that the way he behaves off court and the way he handles himself off court or whenever there's a camera, it's completely different.
Than
the way he is as a player, or even like what other players talk about him when they talk about his personality behind closed doors. That's my issue with Isaiah Thomas. He seems like a very outspoken, sweet guy when he's on camera, when he's on a TV show, but then a lot of people speak badly about him. So there's something wrong there.
You nailed it. Again, second time, wow, two times in a show. There must be something wrong. It must be the quarantine. But yeah, I think you summarized it perfectly. That's my problem with him. Like, you don't know if he's a nice guy or if he's truly a jerk, as they make, as some of the footage reveals him to be. But I mean, we can talk about Isaiah Thomas all day as well. Let's talk about Phil Jackson very quickly as well. So
just one last thing about Isaiah.
Sure.
If he wasn't the way he was when he was a player, so if he didn't behave that way, if he wasn't a tough guy, if the Pistons were not the bad boys, arguably they wouldn't have a ring as well. Because I mean, it was a very difficult time for a team that didn't have as much talent to try to contend for the title. So I don't know, is it justifiable? Not sure. But he got what he wanted, which was to become a champion, right?
Yeah, no, again, that's why I find the Bad Boy Pistons so interesting, because they went down history as this iconic team that beat the living crap out of everyone. But I mean, they had some really good, John Sully was a great player. Isaiah Thomas was a great player. I don't think Lambeer was a great player, but Rodman, you know, great player. And everyone sort of remembers them as this basketball powerhouse. I'm like, I don't know. To me, in basketball terms, they're no better than, I don't know, any of the modern teams. And yet we remember them as a fantastic team.
Yeah, I would like to have a chance. It's never going to happen. It's too late now. But it would be interesting to see Pat Riley coaching the Bad Boy Pistons.
Oh, God, no. I don't know if that would have worked. I don't see Bill Laimbeer doing suicides for Pat Riley. I see Bill Laimbeer drinking while at practice for some reason. This is me, you know, making stuff up. But I for some reason, I can see Bill Laimbeer with a beer going like, nah, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
All right. Phil Jackson, quick question. Greatest coach of all time? Yes or no?
After Mike Dunleavy.
Sure, right. Yeah. What about Donnie Nelson?
No, okay. So now, of course, I'm emotionally attached to Mike Dunleavy because he was the coach of the JO Blazers that made to the Western Conference Finals.
And they're very Bossy Wells, who shared that story that you posted. Shout out.
Yes, they're very close to my heart, you know, the JO Blazers.
Yeah.
And Mike Dunleavy, it's also one of the best Trail Blazers coaches that I had the chance to witness as a basketball fan. But I mean, I'm not sure about Phil Jackson. When I had to put together that starting lineup for the Instagram post that we submitted last week, I selected Lenny Wilkins as the coach. And I think he's another coach that we should put I don't know, top five of all time?
I mean, my knowledge of coaches goes only back so much. But to me, in my eyes, obviously, just like you remember Michael Levy, I obviously remember Phil Jackson as a Lakers fan because he gave the Lakers five championships, along with, obviously, the players. And I do think he, and this is very close in my list with Popovich. I don't know who might be the better coach because I think Popovich is the best basketball coach in terms of, you know, offensive and defense and X's and O's and plays. But Phil Jackson, I think, is the better people person to handle big egos. And not only big egos, to handle anyone. Again, Popovich, great scout, great basketball technical knowledge in my books. But Phil Jackson, he connected with everyone. You know, he shares that story about connecting with Dennis Rodman about, you know, First Nation tribes in the States. And when he was with the Lakers and with the Bulls, and that I read his book, 11 Rings. He said how he would give each player a different book, you know, that they could read on their own time. But that says a lot to, you know, getting to know the person, getting to know what motivates them, and, you know, giving them something that is personal says a lot about a coach.
You know that I love underdogs, so I tend to remember coaches that took teams that were not as talented as the main contenders, and they managed to take them to the finals, or they managed to take them to the Western Conference Finals when the Lakers were the clear favorites. These are the teams that I remember and the coaches that I remember. And I think, I mean, they deserve to be mentioned as a, like a honorable mention, right? For example, Rick Adelman with the Kings. He did a great job there.
But it's not like he had a crappy team either, right? He had really good players.
Yeah, but clearly not good enough to beat the Lakers, right?
But see, that's where I think the players and the coaches have to work together, right? Players have to not only execute and they carry a big part of the load, but coaches, especially Phil Jackson, I think, I remember him as, you know, when he called a timeout, he usually went out to talk to the refs or talk to the assistant coaches. And there were timeouts where he let the players figure it out because he recognized, like, okay, these guys need to figure it out amongst themselves. If I go in and go like, you know, MJ, pass it to Pippen or whatever, right now is not the best course of action. But whenever he needed to draw a play, he would also know how to do that.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's no way around the fact that Phil Jackson is one of the best coaches ever. What other coaches would you put on the list of top five other than Lenny Wilkins, for example?
I think I would have Phil Jackson, Greg Popovich, potentially Don Nelson. Then Pat Riley. And then, oh God, maybe Rudy Tomjanovich? No. Yeah, maybe.
I'm just glad that you didn't mention Eric Spoelstra.
I think he's a great coach, but one of the greatest ever, I don't know. It's also kind of a thing of luck to be a great coach because there's a lot into it. But, you know, we remember the great coaches because they won, right? You could be a fantastic coach and be on a crappy team. I mean, look at Kenny Atkinson, right, with the Nets. He took them to be from being a crappy team to an underdog and a team to be respected. And he parted with the organization. Are we going to remember Kenny Atkinson? No. Is he a good coach? I think so, yeah, absolutely.
And the same can be said, for example, about other coaches. But, I mean, we didn't mention Steve Kerr, because maybe he doesn't get enough credit because the team is a great team, or was a great team, I should say. But his offense and the way that they attack probably revolutionized the league as well. And the same can be said about the Rockets coach that used to be Steve Nash's coach.
D'Antoni.
Mike D'Antoni. Yeah.
Yeah, again, you're absolutely right. Steve Kerr, I think, is still early in his coaching career, and he will go down as a great coach. And D'Antoni's an innovator, right? I think he's only missing the championship to solidify his legacy as a coach, in the NBA at least. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's jump to the most recent episodes, 5 and 6, which are, it was a roller coaster of emotion, if you ask me. Because, you know, the beginning of episode 5, there's that little tribute to Kobe and, you know, Michael Jordan speaking at in 1998 about Kobe Bryant. And, you know, a couple of times he was taking jabs at Kobe, saying like, oh, you better guard him because he's going to take you 1-on-1 and that's where you get him, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, on a more serious note, he said like, it's only a matter of time for him, but he'll get there. So that was pretty emotional. And I couldn't help but, you know, think of the similarities and the part where Kobe appears on the documentary, you know, that I think he was very candid because we know that Kobe loved to be thrown into the discussions of who's the greatest of all time, him, LeBron, or MJ. He loved it. Let's be realistic. But, you know, he said like he hated being compared to Jordan. And I think he was being real about it because he said without Jordan, there's, you know, I got everything that I know from him. So basically without Jordan, there's no Kobe and arguably there's no LeBron, right? So I thought that was a very real moment.
Yeah, and even with MJ's comments about Kobe when he was still a player and Kobe came into the league. So the comments that we were able to witness during the Last Dance, I think they are coming from a competitor, someone that sees him as an opponent, right?
Yeah.
But there's clearly, from the beginning, there was always respect. And yeah. Also, I mean, MJ was also clearly a different player when he joined the league. He was more selfish. And then with Phil Jackson, he learned how to share the ball. The difference is that Kobe never really learned how to do that. That's the only difference.
He's one of, you know, honestly, he, and I can't remember where he's standing, but he's one of the guards with the most assists in NBA history. He had a long career, having said that, but just want to throw it out there. Let's sort of go back to Isaiah Thomas, because a good chunk of episodes 5 and 6 were discussed also about the Dream Team. And part of that storyline is that Isaiah Thomas got snubbed from the team. And people tend to blame Michael Jordan. But you know, let me ask you, do you think that Jordan, even though he says that he had nothing to do with it, had any say in having Isaiah Thomas not on the team?
I'm not sure if he was the main responsible, like the main reason why Isaiah was not selected to join the Dream Team. But it was clear that he was not the only one that didn't want Isaiah to go, right? So again, we go back to that reality that Isaiah is not someone that the other players from his time at least like, right? He's not a very likable opponent at least, but he tries to be a very likable character when he's talking to the media and so on. So I don't think that Isaiah was surprised that he was not selected. He knew that he was not liked by most of the players. So the only reason he would be selected was if the coach wanted to create a necessary drama just to be fair to Isaiah's basketball skills, which as a coach, I don't think I would do that. Like, why would you want to bring attention to a team that it's probably arguably the best team that you could ever put together, right?
Yeah, and I think, again, you nailed it in the sense that, you know, it was not only Michael Jordan in the Dream Team. And the docuseries takes us through that journey that it was, in the beginning, potentially, it was even still Magic and Bird's team. And then Michael Jordan came out to say, no, this is my team. And Isaiah Thomas had already had issues with Magic, with Larry Bird, and I don't think it was just an MJ because, you know, who was the coach of the Dream Team? Chuck Daly. And he was the Pistons coach. Not going to say that they had an issue with each other, but you know, when you're presented with the opportunity to have Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, and Michael Jordan on the same team, and the three of them being excited about playing with each other and competing with each other at practices, it would be stupid for him to create that unnecessary drama that you mentioned. So as a good coach, it was honestly a good perspective and saying, you know what, this works fine. And also you had the best players, the best of the best. The, adding one more player, I don't know if it would have made a difference. I mean, they won it all, so.
Yeah. And the fact that he was Isaiah's coach with the Pistons would create even more unnecessary drama in case he decided to bring him and select him for the Dream Team, even though most players didn't feel comfortable having him as part of the team, right? So, yeah. I mean, it was definitely the right call from his side. Of course, not nice for Isaiah to be left out. But again, it's part of the consequences that he needs to live with for choosing to do whatever was necessary in order to get a ring, right?
Yeah. Now let's talk about that Dream Team and sort of the impact of that they had in the world, in the NBA and basketball in general. I was watching it with my girlfriend, with Anna, who you know, and you know, she was asking me like, do you remember anything? I'm like, well, first of all, I don't, because I was 4 at the time. But I told her, even though I never watched a single game of the Dream Team, I knew about the Dream Team. You know, it's one of those things that it's such an iconic moment in basketball history that, you know, you learn about it. And maybe younger generations might learn about the Redeem Team first, but you know, it all draws back to the Dream Team, right? Even the name, the Dream Team, is such an iconic thing to say. And whenever you say the Dream Team, you know that it's, you know, Michael, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, Charles Barkley, all those players. So yeah. I do think that the Dream Team changed the way that basketball is seen worldwide, because you had, well, Michael Jordan, who is larger than life, playing in front of millions across the world, people that went to the Olympics just to see Michael Jordan, and then they took that back to their home countries, and you know, they came back as basketball fans, probably.
Yeah, no, I think it was an important moment for basketball, and even more important for the NBA, taking into account their goal of becoming a more global league. I think that's probably when the league exploded. And I mean, you can say that when MJ was drafted, maybe with Magic Johnson, with the Showtime Lakers, the league started to become a little bit more global. But I think after the Dream Team was, after Barcelona was when really the whole thing exploded, right? And the league, yeah. The NBA became a global league.
True. Very, very true. Let's switch gears, and we're almost done here with the part of the documentary where, you know, it sort of brings in sneaker culture. And we are told the story about how Michael Jordan, you know, the face of Nike and Jordan, his own line, he wanted to sign with Adidas, with the direct rivals. And I mean, if it hadn't been for Mama Jordan, then maybe Air Jordan, the entire thing would be part of Adidas or Reebok.
And what an amazing move by Nike, right? Whoever was behind that negotiation, I mean, Nike really owns that person a lot of what they became, because there's one Nike before MJ and another Nike completely different after MJ. And I mean, now they are clearly the leaders when it comes to their segment. And of course they have rivals, there are other brands, but Nike, since MJ, they've been leading as far as basketball culture goes. And you could say by far.
Especially you and I, you know, grew up in basketball it's a Nike world after that, right? Up to this day. Yes, there are more brands that are starting to come up again, but it is a Nike world and everyone else is trying to get there. So what I found was hilarious is that, you know, and one of my favorite commercials ever is that Converse weapon commercial where everyone has a little rap and then Larry Bird shows up at the end. And now Nike owns Converse. So the official shoe at the time, Converse, ended up belonging to Nike, who, you know, and they say that the documentary, you know, at the time was sort of a, if not a startup, it was not the behemoth that it is today.
Yeah, I mean, you know that I like smaller brands and I like to buy shoes that are not necessarily the shoes that everyone is buying. And I like to be able to say, I played with N1, I played with Puma, and I have all these different brands that normally people wouldn't buy. But there's no way around the fact that I love a lot of the shoes that Nike has put together. I like their designs. I like the concepts. Having said that, I do not like the fact that they are starting to buy other companies, because I think the other companies that are acquired by Nike, they end up losing a little bit of their personality. So with Converse, for example, I bought Converse basketball shoes before, Dwayne Wade. I also had another one that I really liked that I wasn't able to find. I haven't been able to find pictures of that shoe, but eventually I will be able to find and I will share with you guys. And it was one of my favorite shoes back when I was playing in my high school. But nowadays, when I look at Converse basketball shoes, I can't help but to find a lot of similarities with some of Nike's shoes as well, And I don't necessarily like that.
Having said that, I am a Nike fanboy and you know, I've been pretty transparent about it. I don't feel bad because brands like Converse have been tossed around. I think at one point they belonged to either Adidas or Reebok, one or the other. And, you know, they went bankrupt. They tried to come back. Didn't work out. They went to Adidas or Reebok. They sold them to Nike. And, you know, if there's a brand that, you know, for the sake of the brand itself that wants to, that you might be, want to be part of is in the shoe world, might be Nike or Adidas, you know, one or the other. So I don't really have a problem with that versus, you know, the entire brand disappearing and losing that history. But what I do think is interesting is, again, as a Nike fan and just basketball fan in general, is that what I think, not only Nike got, obviously, Michael Jordan, that part they got it right because they also believed in a rookie, but they decided to go with, I mean, it is thanks to the risk that everyone, including Michael Jordan himself, went for, you know, in trying to give the player a part of their personality in the shoes, that now we have an entire culture around it. You know, had it not been for the Air Jordan ones that were completely different, then we would not have all these colors, all these silhouettes, all these crazy models that we have today. And we take that for granted. I think we take it for granted.
And it's interesting to see how casually it was decided that the shoe would be called Air Jordan. So it was not a huge brainstorm session with a lot of discussions and different strategies and so on. It was just a matter of, okay, we have this new technology called Air, and his last name is Jordan. So why don't we call it Air Jordan? Air Jordan. Okay, it sounds nice. Let's go with Air Jordan. That's how they decided, right? So.
And they, I think was it Michael Jordan's agent tried to justify, like, well, you know, Michael Jordan's game is sort of in the air most of the time, and the technology Air Jordan sounds nice, sure. But and again, we take it for granted, right? But it was such a decision. It was like, sounds okay. Let's go with it. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, that's a good reminder that sometimes it's not very good to overthink. Just go with your gut and your first idea. And
sometimes good enough is good enough. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
All right. Last question before we wrap it up. Right now, at the end of episode 6, we're on a cliffhanger of, you know, I mean, we all know what happened because, you know, history, but how difficult it is to three-peat, you know, after the Bulls were able to do their first three-peat, you could see Michael Jordan being exhausted, being tired, being fed up. Even mm-hmm. during the celebrations, you know, you compare that to the first episode, I think it was episode 4, when they show us footage of his first championship, you know, his crying, holding the Larry O'Brien trophy. And on this one, at the end of the first three-peat, you know, he sounds relieved. He really does. He's like, you know, well, this is over and now we can actually celebrate. And, you know, I'm glad that this whole thing is done. And to their credit, there has been only four, if you want to be very technical, that have been able to complete a three-peat. And that is the Minneapolis Lakers. And this is way back in the 50s. Then the Celtics in the 60s, then the Bulls in the 90s, and then the Lakers in the 2000s. So I think we also, I mean, what I appreciate from this documentary is that it's showing me how we take for granted how difficult and challenging it can be to win a championship, let alone go back-to-back, let alone do a three-peat.
Yeah, no, I think it's not impossible. I think the Warriors could have achieved that. If they were not unlucky with injuries during their run, if they were not so unlucky with injuries during their run, I think they could have achieved that. I mean, it's a huge accomplishment, and I don't want to take anything from their accomplishment. But I think that MJ was not tired about basketball. He was tired with his interaction with the media more than anything else, or even with the fans. You could say that he was tired of how big of a celebrity he became and the fact that he didn't have privacy, he couldn't go out, he was stuck in a hotel room all the time. So I think that's what makes three-peating so difficult. It's not necessarily basketball. It's more about the drama that it's created off court because of the media attention that you start getting, right?
I mean, yeah, I'm not saying he was tired of the game itself, but I can see the challenge in keeping everyone motivated, you know, and the competition, right? There will always be teams that want to beat you and they might have your number. I mean, that game against, I think it was New York, the series against the Knicks, the last game they won by 1 point. And the last play was, it was the center for the Knicks. You know, he had a good 2 to 3 chances of getting the ball in. And he got unlucky. And, you know, it is, let alone the challenge of winning one, it's winning it again against your competition, against yourselves as a team, keeping motivated and everyone on the same line and the same team together as well. Because role players start to, with, I assume, reason, a bigger role, they start demanding more money. They think they're better than what they might be. And then star players are like, I've already proven my point. I'm good. We won. So that initial motivation, that thirst, it's not easy to get it back.
Yeah, and I think that watching The Last Dance was a great way to, you know, take me back to when I was becoming a basketball fan. And it helped me understand the fact that all the teams that have a close place in my heart, they were underdogs. They were the ones that were trying to beat whatever team was dominating at the time. So when you think about the Bulls, back then, one of my favorite teams when I was first becoming an NBA fan were the Orlando Magic. The Magic with Penny Hardaway and Dennis Scott and Shaquille O'Neal. That was my favorite team back then. And then I really, really liked the Indiana Pacers because of Reggie Miller, because he was one of the best three-point shooters of all time, right? So I could basically see him as my idol, as someone that I wanted to be like. And also his competitiveness and the fact that they were also the underdog. And then you move a little bit further down the line, and then you have, of course, the Blazers, which I ultimately became fan, right? But then you also have the Sacramento Kings that I always liked. I always enjoyed watching them play when the Lakers were dominating the league. I don't know why, but it seems to be that I always, at least during the Lakers run in the 90s, early 2000s, I always identified more with the teams from the Western Conference. I never really liked the 76ers with Allen Iverson, because other than Allen Iverson, I couldn't really relate to any players. And I never really liked the New Jersey Nets, for example, because really, I mean, other than Jason Kidd, what else could you enjoy watching when you were watching the New Jersey Nets, right? But the Sacramento Kings and the Trailblazers, they were very good teams back then. Even the Milwaukee Bucks with Ray Allen and Sam Cassell and Glenn Robinson, I enjoyed watching them as well.
You like the little guy, and I will respect that.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, the big teams win, and yeah, it is fun remembering the little guy, that's for sure. But I think that's it for what we have for The Last Dance. Obviously, episodes 7, 8, 9, 10 coming up in the next couple of weeks, and we'll make sure to discuss that. As always, if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, make sure that you rate us 5 stars, leave a review. Otherwise, we'll call Bill and Beer to go to your house and beat you up. And I'm pretty sure he will do it for free, even to this day. So give us 5 stars. Follow us on Instagram, @dropping.dimes. On Twitter, @dropping_dimes1, so you can see everything that we don't post. Facebook.com/dropping.dimes1. Our website, www.dropping-dimes.com. What's wrong with me? Email, our email, last thing, contact@dropping-dimes.com. Raf, it feels like forever, but it feels good to talk about basketball again with you. We'll be back next week. This is the Dropping Dimes crew signing off. Peace out.